Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Glad you're here with us tonight on X Squared Radio. This is a special edition of X Squared Radio tonight. We are going to run two 90-minute sessions back-to-back. So, two 90 minutes, not the regular 60 minutes. And the reason is we have some very important information to bring to you. We have two guests tonight. We have Dr. Tom coming to us, giving us a very, very important update and clarity on the BP oil spill, which is very newsworthy right now. You guys need to hear this, so don't tune away. In the second 90 minutes, we're going to have Aaron Kaplan on, and we're going to talk about the Mars mission and some very interesting stuff coming up for 2012. Aaron Kaplan, author of Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion. So stick around, because we're going to bring all that to you tonight, and it's going to be exciting. You won't want to leave. Please call your friends and tell them to tune in right now. Sunspot 1087, we were waiting for it, and it came. It erupted on July 17th, yesterday, producing a long-duration C2-class solar flare. The leisurely but powerful eruption hurled a faint coronal mass ejection into space. Minor geomagnetic storms are possible on or about July 20th, which is the day after tomorrow. It takes about 73 hours for this stuff to reach the Earth. The Arctic sky watchers won't likely see auroras because of the midnight sun. Antarctic sky watchers, however, should be alert for southern lights. There were 35 earthquakes over the last 24 hours, over 3.0. Three of them were over 5.0, two were over 6.0, and one was over 7.0. Alaska and New Guinea are the hot spots, opposite sides of the planet. What's going on? Boy, we have a lot of geological activity today. No asteroids of any size have come within 5 lunar distances of Earth in the past 30 days. However, we only get reports on the ones that have passed already. If we hear about any on the way, we'll see if we let you know in time. Well, maybe not. I don't know. I want you to pay close attention, because the information that I'm going to give you right now is going to fit with global warming, and it's not going to fit with global warming. NASA-funded researchers are monitoring a big event in our planet's atmosphere. That's right, high above Earth's surface, where the atmosphere meets space. Now, this was only 3 days ago. A rarefied layer of gas called the thermosphere recently collapsed, and now it's rebounding again. Layers of Earth's atmosphere, we have high above the planet, very close to a very low temperature. It's called the thermosphere. It is above the mesosphere, the stratosphere, you're familiar with the troposphere, which is where we, live. But this thermosphere is very important. This is the biggest contraction of the thermosphere in the last 43 years, says John Emmett of the Naval Research Lab, lead author of a paper announcing the finding in the June 19th issue of the Geophysical Research Letters. It's a space age record. The collapse happened during the deep solar minimum of 2008-2009, a fact which comes as little surprise to researchers. The thermosphere always cools and contracts when solar activity is low. In this case, however, the magnitude of the collapse was 2 to 3 times greater than low solar activity could explain. He goes on to say, something is going on that we do not understand. Close quote. The thermosphere ranges in altitude from 90 kilometers to 600 plus kilometers. It's way out there. It's a very protective layer around the Earth. It is a realm of meteors, auroras, satellites, which skim to the thermosphere as they circle Earth. It is also where solar radiation makes first contact with our planet. The thermosphere intercepts extreme ultraviolet photons from the sun before they can reach the ground. When solar activity is high, the solar EUV warms the thermosphere, causing it to puff up like a marshmallow held up over a campfire. When the solar activity is low, the opposite happens. Lately, however, solar activity has been very low. In 2008 and 2009, if you've been listening to this program, you're aware of that. The sun has been kind of sleeping. Solar cycle 24 is way, way, way late starting. Sunspots were scarce, solar flares almost non-existent, and solar EUV radiation was at a low ebb. Researchers immediately turned their attention to the thermosphere to see what would happen. This was a very rare chance to get a look at it. Well, what happened was they got data that puzzled them. How do you know what's going to happen all the way up there in the thermosphere? Well, Dr. Emmett uses a clever technique because satellites feel aerodynamic drag when they move through the thermosphere. It's possible to monitor conditions there by watching the satellites decay. Interestingly enough, the numbers were way off the charts. He says the numbers don't quite add up. Even when we take CO2 into account, using our best understanding of how it operates as a coolant in the atmosphere, we can't fully explain the thermosphere's collapse. This is very strange stuff, people, and we're going to stay right on top of this. We will let you know what's going on. Now, on the other side of the government is another organization called the NOAA. We often talk about that here. Last month's combined global land and ocean surface temperature made it the warmest June on record. And the warmest on record averaged for any April through June and January through June periods. Worldwide average land surface temperature was the warmest on record since they've been keeping records in 1880. Now, that's not a big window, but it is very clear that the warming of the water and the land that we thought had peaked out in 1998 and was headed back down did not peak. The global June land surface temperature was up 1.93 degrees Fahrenheit, and the ocean temperature was up almost a full degree Fahrenheit. Now, admittedly, this isn't a big change, but it is a trend in the wrong direction. It is not what we wanted to see during a solar minimum. During a solar minimum, we expected to see a lot less solar energy absorbed by the Earth. We usually see that go up during solar maximums and fall back down during solar minimums. It didn't fall back down. So if you're out there experiencing 100 degree plus weather, or if you had a particularly bad winter this year, it's really puzzling. We really don't know why. The Arctic Sea is dropping by 10% in ice coverage, and the Antarctic Sea is up 8.3% for the same period of time. How can the Earth build ice on one side and lose ice on the other side? Very interesting questions. But there are other forces afoot, and our guest tonight is going to bring some information tonight to us that you have not heard before. Now, trust me. We don't do conspiracy theories at this program. We try to vet every single source that we get. And I can tell you that the source is impeccable. The information that you are about to receive is so earth-shaking, you may not see this on the mainstream press, but believe me, every bit of it is factual. Don't go away. 40 seconds. We'll be right back with Dr. Tom.
Expands consciousness. The spice. is Vitalife Space Travel.
Okay, those of you live with us here on July 18, 2010, know this is not an archive. This is not a test. This is the real thing. Most of you know by reading the news or by watching online news that the BP oil spill has been capped. At least that's what they want you to believe. What they are releasing is a little bit of information to sort of prepare you for what may be coming. The worst scenario would be that low pressure on this well indicates that there are some small undetected leaks in the well casing, a long pipe that stretches from the sea floor down through some 14,000 feet of subsea rock into a giant oil reservoir deep underground, more than a mile under the ocean. Concern about keeping the well casing intact was what forced BP to abort an early effort to plug the well using a tactic called the top kill. Now, the top kill is what we suggested on this program a month ago. We've used it on wells on land that have too high a pressure to pull the steel from. We drilled it wrong, so we back out of it and try again. We top kill it and then cut the pipe and seal the well. This is where you pump heavy mud into the well and then concrete behind it, and you let it set up, and you literally plug off that well with solid concrete. They opted not to do this. At first, I thought it was because they wanted to save the well. They wanted to produce it. It was worth a couple of trillion dollars. But there may be something else going on here, and my guest tonight may have the answer. Welcome to the program, Dr. Tom.
Welcome to you, Brooks, and thanks so much for having us here.
Well, it's my pleasure. You know, Dr. Tom made contact with me earlier in the week, and I had said, well, you know, we can talk about this for an hour. He assured me that there is so much information here, so much energy behind this. We could easily go for 3 hours. We don't have 3 hours. We have 90 minutes. So we're going to jump into this, people. So fasten your seatbelt. Make sure that your seat is reclined and you are looking out the window. Here we go. So what is the condition? What are we to believe from BP right now?
Well, Brooks, we just actually, interestingly enough, we released an article today on the Internet, and the title of it is Pressure at the Wellhead and What It Really Means. And I think of all the articles that we published over the past 3 months with our Gulf Oil Remediation Conference, which is an international conference, by the way, cyber conference that draws from the best and the brightest from folks around the world, petroleum engineers, mechanical engineers, physicists, geologists, people who are deep in the industry of oil and gas exploration, drilling, extraction for decades. So they know the patterns. They know the trends. They know the signature points. They know exactly what to look for. And it doesn't take long for these folks to put a bunch of dots up in the radar screen, connect them, and come up with one very, very serious picture here. And it looks like this. Of course, the article that was entitled Pressure at the Wellhead, and what does it really mean? Well, when the pressure does not exceed a certain threshold, we know unequivocally that the system has been breached. Okay, that's unequivocal. And actually, Huffington Post and Yahoo and AOL.com just today have come up with articles where there's a feud going on between BP and the federal government about what to do now, because there is methane in the water, and there's a methane seep that they've identified right there in the area around the wellhead. So this is coming out in the mainstream media. It took them a few days to get it out, but we knew it was coming. And
is this methane that's leaking up around the well casing where the well casing's been breached, or is this coming from the strata itself, from between the geology where they drilled into the oil and the bottom of the sea?
That's a very good question. And you know, in good conscience, in a million years, I couldn't answer that question with a high degree of accuracy or authority. You know that. But I'll answer it this way. When a system is breached, and remember, it can be breached in many areas, It can be a low breach. It can be below, way below the relief wells that they're trying to tie into this. It can be breached above the relief wells. There are a lot of places for breaching in the system. The article that we published speaks directly to the improper cementing that BP and Halliburton conducted. And because of the improper cementing of the well casing to the well bore, okay, there's cement that they squeeze up there to fixate the actual casing so that it's stationary within the well bore. Well, that wasn't done correctly, and there's a very serious academic piece on this where it's documented that was not done correctly, and because of it, it gives many points of egress for the effluent, the hydrocarbon effluent that's pushing up at great pressure. And if there's any pathway of egress, methane is going to find it, right?
Let's talk about that just a couple of seconds. You know, people have said in the news that improper techniques were used. It's true. What happened from what my investigation has shown is normally when they cement a well, they leave the heavy mud in the hole, and they literally push the mud through the process with the cement, and that makes a nice, clean, high-pressure, solid kind of plug on the outside of that casing, between the casing and the strata itself. A few days before the cementing process, BP filed for a waiver from the government regulatory agency over this operation, and they granted it. Now, you got to know that Transocean has tried this many times before. 69 times Transocean has done this, and it has resulted in a fire caused by this exact thing, methane, bubbling up through the concrete because there's no back pressure. There's no mud on top of the concrete. Now, is it a mess to use the mud and then pump the concrete in? Of course it is. It's more difficult. But they asked for a waiver, and they got it, and this is what literally caused the explosion.
You're correct. The methane, the process that you outline is exactly what happened. In the article that we published goes into it in great detail. So you did a very nice explanation of how this whole situation was set up. And remember, this is just one mechanism that broke down. We know that there were a series of mechanisms that broke down. That, you know, it was a perfect storm created from a lot of mini perfect storms that came together. But the $64,000 question is, where is the methane coming from? Methane, you know, comes from a lot of different areas, you know, undersea. And, of course, in the hydrocarbon brew that's coming up from the mantle, this is obviously usually about 60% of the composition of the effluent that comes out of the riser. But you've also got methane hydrate. You've got methane hydrate that collects on the undersea floor, as you know. And when things happen to the undersea floor, like things start to heat up, well, global warming, when the environment down there is affected in whatever way through either mechanical or temperature changes, so that methane hydrate that's frozen in place by high pressure and very low temperature starts to come out of its slumber, and it starts to transmute. And, of course, it has one place to go, and that's north. What dissolves in the seawater will dissolve in the seawater, and what doesn't will sit around there, and much of it will eventually rise to the surface of the Gulf and find exit above the surface and then form little concentrations of methane, which they have found up to a million times higher than usual. Which is obviously indicative of serious methane seeps.
One of the things that people see and have seen on television is this sort of a pressure gauge with a, you know, red zone and yellow zone and green zone. And it's a little difficult for the average person to understand why low pressure is bad and high pressure is good. Here's what the article says. It says readings of up to 7,500 pounds per square inch would indicate high integrity and low potential for a leak, Allen told CNN. Pressures reading from Saturday morning, which is yesterday morning, were 6,700 pounds per square inch and slowly rising. That is approximately 1,000 PSI off. If we're talking about the gas cap that is on top of this volcanic bubble, which is some 14,000 feet under the sea floor, which is where they found this oil pooled and under very high pressure, if that cap has actually lowered in pressure 1,000 psi, we have a very serious problem. If, however, there is gas pushing through the strata, through cracks that somehow might have been formed either through geotechnic activity or through fracking activity. Fracking is a term that means fracturing of the strata using underground explosives or high-pressure acid. They use this to create a better flow to the hole. Nine times out of ten, you don't hit the structure exactly with your drill hole. You're just punching a little 10-inch hole in the ground. So you fracture the structure to allow the hole to be the exit point of any oil that might be close to that hole. If that strata has been compromised by this activity and that pressure has dropped to what it's reading on that gauge, we might have an intra-strata leak, and this could be catastrophic. How so?
Well, and what you pointed out is you know, the speculation that, of course, Richard Hoagland has been talking about on the Internet about a gas bubble that is aggregating through the upward movement of methane through exactly these fissures and cracks in the strata, the subsea strata, and collecting in a, what he says, a 10 to 20 mile long gas bubble with 10 feet diameter or width to it. I'm not speaking to that. That may be there, may not be there. I am. They have the EM technology, the ultrasound form of EM technology to really, really understand if that is there. They do have that technology. I'm sure that they've applied the technology. If they have found that it is there, they obviously haven't told us. Okay, if they found it, if it is there, if these kinds of gas accumulations do exist under the seafloor and they are continuing to grow, they will grow to a point, obviously, where you know, it gets to the point where there's no more structure to fill, and it has to find egress somehow. And of course, this is where the speculation enters in that there could be, you know, an explosion. I'm not speaking to that because I don't. I've talked to enough people about those possibilities that I do know that they do exist. Whether it exists in the instant case, I don't have the authority or the knowledge to speak to that because I haven't seen the data. But I will say this: if it does exist, depending on where it is, they see these things. This is not new, and they do have technology. They're just, you know. When you've got an abscess in your tooth, the dentist comes along and pokes away at the abscess and relieves the pressure. So there are technologies that are available whereby, depending on how deep that is and how large it is and how much pressure is built up, there are things that they can do to relieve that pressure, to remove some sort of catastrophic event around it. But again, I don't want to say anything this evening that will give credence to that because I really don't know. However, I do know this, that methane travels up through the earth in many mysterious ways, and methane seeps exist naturally all over the seafloor. I mean, this is common. However, when you bore a 15 or 17 or 20,000 foot hole into the earth beyond the strata that the seeps, these more shallow seeps are coming up from, what you do is you allow for much greater volumes of methane to come northward up to the seafloor, and to do so with a pressure, because these pressures in the mantle are much, much greater than the pressures that are usually found around much more superficial prospects. This is deep. And I want to point out one thing. You hear a lot of depths, you know, that are being thrown around about this particular prospect, the Macondo prospect. Is it 15,000? Is it 20,000? Is it 25,000 or 30,000? we really have never been told officially. Okay, we do not know with any degree of authority.
I did some digging, and I tried to find out how deep the actual hole is, and he is exactly right. I found numbers 14,400 all the way to 28,500. Actually, the deeper it is, the safer we are. The closer to the surface we get, the more dangerous it becomes, because if this pressure were to get below the flash point of whatever gas is being held in liquid state in that volcanic bubble, then it will flash to gas, and that is what we call a super volcano. Now, that would be not only devastating; it would be catastrophic to the Gulf Ocean. I don't want to say that it's a possibility, because remember, it is under about 160 atmospheres of oceanic pressure, so it has that weight on top of the strata to keep it behaving itself, not like the bubble that's in Yosemite, which is a similar type of structure. Not oil, but certainly the gaseous, combustible gas that's held down in there in liquid form. If it decides to flash off to gas, that's what we call a supervolcano. What I do want to get into, because we're kind of limited on time, is the players that are involved here, the risks that are well known, because ocean drilling has been going on for well over 100 years, and we know what happens when we have problems with ocean rigs. Transocean's probably one of the most experienced, because they've notoriously had the most problems. What happens when we follow the money, when we actually follow the players that are involved here? What happens when we start looking at that picture?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that question, following that line of inquiry, will point to the root causes. If you follow that line of inquiry all the way back to the sources, you will ultimately come to a point of understanding the all of the places in the process, the U.S. regulatory process, whether it's MMS or Department of Energy or Department of Interior or EPA or Department of Homeland Security, all of these departments. This is U.S. territorial waters, 43 miles from Venice, Louisiana. So this is well within U.S. territorial waters, and therefore all of the appropriate regulatory regimes that ought to have been in place weren't in place. Whatever was supposed to happen didn't happen, and no one's talking about it. But the key thing is, well, how does that relate to the well blowing? Well, the only reason why the well blew is because, you know, people like to say that everything went wrong that could have gone wrong, and that's true. But everything went wrong because no one made sure it went right. And where regulation is absent, a for-profit, publicly owned corporation is going to cut corners every place it can. And BP, being the granddaddy of the super majors, the six super majors of the oil and gas corporations, largest oil and gas companies in the world, is notorious for cutting corners even when they are regulated and there is appropriate or proper oversight. So when you follow that money, your question, you really have to look at the lobbyist. And you actually have to dig a little deeper in the industry and understanding that the granddaddy here of BP was the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, 1908, founded by a Mr. Darcy. They were the very first to develop oil and gas reserves in the Middle East. Okay, very first. So this is their stomping ground, and you can imagine all of the graft and corruption and paying off and the wars and the institutionalized theft that they've engaged in for the past 100 years to just get their way.
Sure. Yeah, I a lot of people don't remember this, but many years ago, probably more than 25 years ago, there was a public campaign to change the name of an oil company. You remember Radar O'Reilly from MASH series did a series of infomercials and public service announcements because this oil company used to be called Gulf Oil, and they changed their name to BP.
Yeah. So there you go. So you when you understand them, you know, BP is the granddaddy, and they do it their way or the highway. And in the Middle East, you have to understand the culture, the actual culture of the industry is very important to understand. And I speak from my experience as the chief of staff to Dr. Thomas B. Manton, who was the very first CEO and president of the International Oil Spill Control Corporation. Of course, I've been on the phone with Tom all day today, and we talk about, you know, what's going on here. And I've been working with him since the day this blew off, by the way. And he's given me a lot of very, very revealing history about BP as a company and the way they operated in the Middle East. It could be said that Tom was put to work because BP was not in the oil spill control business. They were in the drilling and extraction business. So he was tasked with designing and implementing oil spill control programs for entire nations within OPEC. This is what he did for Saudi Arabia. And they had to put together programs that were extremely tight and, you know, very technically proficient because they have these huge desalinization plants that if oil or gas got into these RO filters, these membranes, we're talking about, you know, $500,000 plants would be shut down. And this
well,
is
not,
get the
not you lose all the fresh water to the people. You'd have, you know, you'd have a disaster on your hands. So what happened? I mean, you know, the techniques they're using to clean up this oil spill are techniques that are 40 years old, and they never have worked. What happened?
Well, here you go. Here's a short answer, and Tom has drilled this in my head many times. He said, you'd often say, Tom, you know, the big difference between the way the British have always handled oil spills and the way that the other side handled oil spills is that they always use their dispersants at the wellhead to basically disperse it. And this was their modus operandi. This is what they did. Because remember, they're not paid to clean spills. They're paid to capture oil. Well, when in town was, you know, was the in the 70s, by the way, was the first. I mean, if you understand the history, Brooks, there was no formal oil spill control until the 70s. It didn't exist. And the Middle Eastern countries were concerned about their beaches becoming overwrought with tar balls and their water, you know, their desalinization plants becoming compromised, et cetera. So they had to do this. There was no choice. So that this difference in strategy, the British using their dispersants, the other side saying, no, we need to capture the oil, let it aggregate, get the skimmers out and collect it, and then dispose of it in the most non-toxic, safe, appropriate way. There's a real divergence here in philosophies, and that's what we're seeing in the Gulf of Mexico, where they're taking their Corexit, a dispersant that's illegal, outlawed in the UK, using it not just liberally, but volumes, untold volumes, perhaps the most that's ever been used in the history of oil spill control in the world.
Oh yeah, I mean they're dropping it by airplanes, and there are pictures on the net, high altitude pictures of these airplanes literally flying at low altitude, dropping dispersant right on the water. Now people think dispersant is like, you know, Joy dishwashing liquid. It's not. We're talking about methyl chlorides. And the shocking thing is, if you were to put a chemical on your fishing boat, you have to have an MSDS on file on that boat and with the Coast Guard, what that chemical is you have on your boat, even if it's ordinary deck cleaner. We can't get an MSDS on this dispersant because the oil companies say it's a proprietary formula, and they don't want that formula to get out to competitors. Well, methyl chlorides it's an awesome degreaser. We used it a lot when we were in the 70s and 80s, even in the automotive industry. But it is a carcinogen, and when it reaches about 80 or 90 degrees Fahrenheit, it goes gaseous. and it floats above the ground about 18 to 24 inches like a blanket of poisonous gas. Now, according to the EPA, the limits on this gas are about 40 to 50 parts per billion with a B. And they have been measuring this gas ashore, onshore, even though they're spraying this out at sea, in the 1,500 to 2,000 parts per billion range. This is way above the safe limits. And the biological systems that are most affected are those that have rapid life cycles, like frogs and tadpoles, mosquitoes, babies, and those rapidly developing biological systems. So the dispersants are worse than the oil.
Absolutely. And I'm board certified in integrative medicine, Brooke, so you can imagine how horrified I am through all of my clients in North Florida who have EI syndrome. They've got MCS. They've got all these alphabet soup diseases of the 21st century, you know, all these multi-infection syndromes that render them extremely hyperreactive, hypersensitive to all of these aerosol and airborne types of contaminants. So I'm sitting here saying, what are we doing from a health standpoint? It's going to cause a medical emergency that this country has never seen. And this is what I speak to, really. It's the interactions. You know what it's like. You know, someone's got their prescription, and okay, they're okay, and then they put another prescription on top of that, and now they're starting to get a little sick. And then they add another third prescription, and before you know it, after 10 prescriptions in their medicine cabinet, they're really doing bad because of the interactions between these powerful chemicals in the 10 different prescriptions they're taking every day. So the interactions between a very powerful, and I've read a quote-unquote MSDS sheet. It's a speculated MSDS sheet on the Corexit, and this stuff is as bad as it gets. I mean, it's just inconceivable that the U.S. federal government would not arrest BP for breaking every EPA law on the books. It's just, to me, it's inconceivable.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, recently even mainstream media has run up against this. You're exactly right. There are a lot of federal laws that are being broken here. Environmental laws, process laws, safety laws, freedom of the press laws, which are extremely well protected in this country. And yet, BP has been able to get felony charges threatened and lodged against news outlets that try to interview workers, try to take photographs of what's being done. $40,000 fine and a Class B felony charge. How does BP rate being able, as a private corporation, to not only usurp the regulations, but to command the judicial branch to issue this kind of retaliation against people that are trying to hold BP's feet to the fire?
It's a very good point, and I experienced that directly at the first major meeting in Florida, North Florida, just south here in the Gulf. I went to it at St. Teresa, the FSU Marine Lab, and there, present at the meeting, a full half-day meeting, were all the executives from BP and the U.S. Coast Guard and the state of Florida and all the counties and cities and NGOs, et cetera, that were going to be involved in the relief effort. And at that meeting, it was pointed out to everyone present that BP would be the chief component of a unified command structure that would dictate to the counties that typically have command and control of their shoreline. They know their shoreline, and that's their job. And so at the meeting, I knew many of the attorneys there and many of the politicos there, people running for office in North Florida, and a number of them got up and just in protest said, you mean to tell me you're going to give a foreign multinational corporation essentially command and control over U.S. territorial waters in the shoreline? I said, and they were jumping right up and getting in the face of everyone that was conducting the meeting. And of course, they were pointing out the obvious. And what it did is it exposed the fact that in fact the U.S. federal government has handed over unconstitutionally power to a foreign multinational corporation that can only be they can only occur unless it's unlawfully arrogated unto it. You understand what I'm saying? That not just in violation of the U.S. Constitution, but in total violation of those states' rights and the sovereignty of those states to protect person and property. So we have a huge clash. I mean, a monumental clash here. And you have to understand the context. This is very important. And being in the Gulf Coast, I watch this real closely for 15 years because I'm a rather avid environmental health advocate, and I'm bumping up against the system, whether it's the feds or the state or whoever, all the time. And there's one thing that we understand here, and that is when it comes to oil and gas, Louisiana, Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, they have given up their right. They've given up their power. Effectively, the oil and gas companies have owned that land. Those are their leases. And this is their property. It has been for as long as there's been drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. So they're used to owning it, running it. And it's in lockdown. It's in the state of martial law for as long as they've been doing it. And so this is why you see this pattern of bullying and taking command and control, where you just say, how in the world are they getting away with it? Because this is what they've always done, except that this catastrophe has given them a chance to really flex their muscles in a way that you didn't see them flex their muscles in the past.
Let me throw a little history lesson here, because a lot of people don't understand how this evolved. Back in, let's call it colonial days of the West, the only way to really get men and materials, especially people that weren't used to riding wagon trains to the West, was the railroad. And the railroad ran on coal. And later it ran on diesel fuel. The railroad was financed West by the oil companies in exchange for oil and gas and gold mineral rights for many miles on either side of the railroad tracks. And the railroad controls those royalties, it's called eminent domain, since those tracks were laid down. Their reasoning was, we're taking a big risk by running railroads to nowhere, hoping that someday towns and cities will spring up along this railroad and do commerce. So we're doing an investment in infrastructure that we're not going to see a payback for probably 50 or 75 years. Well, now that payback is happening. And the railroad and the oil companies have merged. And so now what you have is not a national monopoly. You have a global monopoly. The oil and gas rights in the United States are mostly owned by multinational corporations. It is not American energy any longer. And so that's what Dr. Thomas is talking about. These eminent domain mineral rights go back all the way to the mid-1800s. And that's why Mississippi schools are some of the worst in the country. That's why Alabama has one of the worst economies in the country. And that's why Texas struggles with it every single day, these oil and gas lease rights.
It's a very good point that you make, Brooks, and I appreciate some of that history. I didn't know myself, but it has fleshed out the skeleton of what I've seen in living color here in the Gulf of Mexico very nicely. Let me point out one very important piece of this that I think will gel in your listeners' minds very, very quickly about why this has blown up the way it has, and that is this. And I refer to an article on the Internet that very clearly elucidates what I'm about to say, called The Gulf Oil Spill, A Matter of National Security. We go back to the G.W. Bush years when George W. Bush was courting Tony Blair, looking for British support for the illegal invasion of Iraq. And he was doing that really just because he needed cover, political cover from another nation, so that, they could go in with a coalition of the willing to invade Iraq. Well, one of the major concessions that Great Britain made to join forces, what's a liberal Democrat like Tony Blair even joining forces with a conservative Republican like George Bush in the first place? How does this happen? except by some serious cattle swapping in the background, and that's just what happened. BP, the largest corporation in Great Britain, okay, this is the largest, it's the fourth largest corporation in the world, the largest in Great Britain, was given rights, leases, and access to U.S. offshore oil fields very liberally as a concession to join that war in Iraq. So people are wondering, how does BP exercise so much power? I mean, not just in the Gulf of Mexico, but seemingly in the corridors of power throughout the entire United States governmental apparatus. They do what they want to do anytime they want to do it. They don't do what they don't want to do. And so when you understand that a deal was made, and when a deal is made, it's done. And the deal is, we give you all this access to oil and gas leases. You take it. You develop it, explore it, and you join us in our war to Iraq. And so this business deal cut behind the scenes is really a draw. And, you know, when you're doing business, people say, well, why don't you just go back and, you know, break the deal or renegotiate it? It's done. And, of course, this kind of information is not in the MSM. They will never report this because this is verboten. The whole Tony Blair, George W. Bush relationship was built around a deal for them to climb on board the Iraq war. And this is the way it was done. Now, there are other reasons why it was done that way. BP, being a foreign multinational corporation, can do things in U.S. territorial waters that a U.S. corporation can't do.
Sure, and they can do things in other waters and even on land that other corporations can't do. By the way, a little caveat, Tony Blair is no longer Prime Minister of Britain, but he recently joined a green tech venture capital company called Khosla Ventures, K-H-O-S-L-A. Guess what their main area of investment is? Green energy.
So, you know, they're always working both sides of the equation very conveniently. That's their modus operandi. So, so the upshot of this whole discussion is that, you know, I mean, because everyone comes up to me constantly and says, how is it that a foreign multinational corporation has complete command and control? Effectively, they are enforcing martial law in U.S. territorial waters. I mean, this is just mind-blowing to all the patriots down here in the South, you know, all these good old boys and all these, you know, good old, they can't figure it out. And unless you walk down these lines of inquiry that you and I have done this evening, it's unfathomable. It's completely inscrutable. And I think that what you're doing...
Let me ask you a question. Are we going to march down the same path that those people were sent down up with the Exxon Valdez spill? Or are these people more empowered? Are they more knowledgeable? Are they more capable than they were during the Exxon Valdez spill? Or are they going the same way? Are we going to be treated the same way?
I will answer it this way, and I just talked to Ricky Ott for about a half an hour, 45 minutes the night before last, she is the pioneer and the torchbearer for everything that went wrong in Prince Albert Sound and in Alaska in the wake of the Exxon Valdez. Two very good friends of mine, Robert Cornelier and Paul Carvalho, the director and producer of Black Wave, which is a 21-year retrospective of what happened, the tearing of the social fabric, the irrevocable collapse of socially, economically, politically, of all things connected to that oil spill. And they did probably the best documentary I've ever seen in my life. We have the benefit of that, Brooks. They didn't have that then. And, of course, Alaska is a lot different than Florida. And what am I speaking to you about now? This is Florida. This is not Alaska. This is not Louisiana, where you can take $5,000 and buy off a fisherman and ask him to waive away all future rights to compensation for lost business income, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is Florida, the land of make-believe, but it's also the land of a lot of rich people. Okay, so you've got the greatest concentration of wealth from Clearwater down to Naples, the greatest concentration of wealth in the world from Stewart to Key West, And I'm not just talking about real estate, commercial and residential real estate. I'm talking about the people who domicile there. We're talking about the greatest net worths in the aggregate in the world. So,
well, we're also talking about a great Rolodex of law firms and lawyers in Florida as well.
There you go. And of course, when this blew off, we immediately, all of the environmental attorneys that I deal with, I wrote a couple of articles, and we got together and really started pounding away. And we wrote articles about how BP's assets should be seized immediately. And they're out there in the public domain. You can Google and find those articles. Well, the most powerful environmental law firm, probably east of the Mississippi, Levin Pep Antonio, our Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is of counsel for them. They have literally initiated the process on getting the ball rolling with a criminal RICO suit against BP. This is a criminal RICO suit, not a civil. A criminal RICO suit against BP would be an unprecedented act. It'd be the first
against,
of its
against
kind.
Against a private corporation? RICO against a private corporation?
Yeah, so this is the fierceness. You know, everyone says that if we're going to take the country back, it's got to start, the South has to rise, and it's true. The South is rising because of what injustices are being perpetrated in its waters and on its land. And when you've got the largest environmental firm working with state's attorney generals and U.S. attorney generals, because a criminal RICO suit can only be filed by a jurisdiction, by a federal jurisdiction. And so the initiative revolves around getting all the state attorney generals together with the feds and piecing together a very tight, legally based criminal RICO suit against BP. Now, that wouldn't happen in Alaska. I'm just giving you an example of that couldn't happen in Alaska. And Brian O'Neill up at Fabre up in Minnesota, who did a lot of the legal work for those great people of Alaska. I mean, he's a great guy, and he did great work. But, you know, we're talking about Florida, and we have a group called the Concerned Citizens of Florida, and we are made up of the largest yacht clubs, country clubs, golf clubs, gated communities, stretching 1,250 miles of coastline. And
let me ask you a question here. How many? I mean, this takes. Jurisdictional involvement on a executive level. In other words, you got to have governors involved when you enacted the RICO Act against a private corporation. How many governors are involved in this?
Well, you know, I will say this. I'm personally speaking with the Republican National Committee. I've given two presentations before them on bringing the Republican Party, because four of those governors, as you know, our Republican, Charlie Crist, who's about 10 minutes away from my home here in Tallahassee, is now independent. And he's in a rough spot. Charlie Crist is in a rough spot right now, and I'll get into that in a moment. The Republican governors are being empowered by their party. Okay, and I actually spoke directly to Michael Steele, the chairman, and his chief of staff, and a number of others in the Republican Party, presenting to them our plan. We have a plan to remediate, mitigate, protect the entire Gulf coastline of the entire Gulf Coast, USA Gulf Coast. And they took it so seriously that they are now setting up meetings with us, with each individual governor, their chiefs of staff, their DEP secretaries, their directors of emergency services, so that we can lay out an operational plan to begin doing the remediating and the protecting before things get out of hand. And believe me, they're going to get out of hand very soon.
Yeah, well, I it's going to get out of hand on several different levels. One of the things that I want to bring to the listeners' attention here is the RICO Act is generally used for racketeering. It's for conspiracies on a multiple level that allows investigators to seize bank accounts, track the movement of money electronically and through the mail, and look at phone records and things like that in order to try to build a case that would not normally, through normal law enforcement activities, not normally make itself evident. The risk here is that we are setting a precedent to allow government to not go after a criminal, a specific person, like, say, Al Capone or Enron executives or someone like that. You're going after a private corporation. This sets a dangerous precedent, which is something like fascism, if it gets out of hand. This kind of precedent needs to be laid very, very carefully so that subsequent administrations cannot stand upon this precedent, this movement against BP, some or all of its assets, and seize another corporation that maybe doesn't agree with the government.
Yeah, and your point is well taken. And I'm, you know, I am not for the liberal utilization of criminal RICO, but let's be clear about what's happened here. We have a crime against an entire region of the USA. We have a crime against a body of water. We'll call it aquicide. We have a crime against humanity. The loop current, as it brings it around the peninsula and it's captured by the Gulf Stream, it's already being brought up right back to Great Britain, by the way. That's where it's going. That's where the Gulf Stream brings it. So once it gets into the Atlantic Ocean, it'll be taken by all the currents, undersea, above sea, et cetera. It's going to find its vectors of dissemination. Ultimately, it will find its way into the seven seas. So we have a crime against the planet, and that's what this is. This is a crime against the planet. And our basis here is that whether you are a person or a corporation, no one has the right to commit a crime against the planet as profound and fundamental as this one is. And this is a crime. Make no mistake about it. So whether you're a person or corporate body, if you commit a crime, you have to be held responsible for it. You know, if you committed one, Brooks, you know what would happen to you right now. And likewise, a corporation that's given personhood, they have the shield of limited liability to hide behind. That has to be stripped away in instances where the crime is so egregious as it is in this case. And there's not an attorney in Florida that doesn't agree with this line of reasoning. Something has to happen.
RICO is designed to put people in jail. It isn't designed to put corporations in jail. It's designed to go after individual criminals. You're talking about policies that are set forth by multinational corporation that have resulted over the years in the death of more than 115 oil rig workers and now almost the death of an ocean. And these are the kinds of activities they need to be held accountable for. I'm just worried that the RICO Act is maybe not the mechanism that you want to put into place. And I'm also afraid of greatly empowering and funding the EPA to do it as well, because the EPA is responsible for holding back so much green energy from coming to fruition. Now, one of the things that I've noticed, Dr. Tom, we've got about a half an hour left, is I am already seeing the marketing campaign in the press, within hours of when this supposed cap was put into place, the press was talking about the water being clean. They're starting to use words like clean and clear, and we're on our way to recovery, and we'll soon have this behind us. People don't realize that this oil has already gotten into the marshlands. The marshlands where the grasses grow, where the larvae are spawned, where the crabs and the clams and everything get their birth. And if those marshes die, you're going to see states float out to sea just like the Mississippi Delta.
That's absolutely true. The delicate balance. I mean, even when things are going well in the Gulf, you know, we're talking about a Mississippi River that dumps a degree of effluent, chemical fertilizers, herbicides, fungicides, bovine growth hormones, GMO-laden products. I mean, you can imagine the Mississippi bringing all of that from the heartland of America. I mean, essentially, there were whole dead zones identified in the Gulf of Mexico before this even jumped off. So now you've taken a heavily burdened system and you've created a petrochemical stew with Corexit, additive, highly toxic, poisonous additive. And I hope your listeners understand that it is no longer safe to eat seafood from the Gulf of Mexico. It's that simple. And once it gets up the eastern seaboard, it will no longer be safe for a long time to eat seafood from the eastern seaboard. So we have a problem, a real problem. And the upshot.
Who's in charge of determining how safe is safe? I mean, the Food and Drug Administration is supposedly the nation's food protector. What exactly is the FDA's role in this process? I mean, how can you tell where seafood's coming from anyway?
Yeah, that's a very good, that right there is the, you know, I'm a vegetarian, thankfully, and I don't have to consider these questions, but if you're a real seafood eater, which many people are, they've gotten off the beef diet and they've gone to seafood, which is a very healthy alternative for them. And those people have to really seriously consider, you know, oysters, there are certain kinds of oysters and clams and whatnot that only come from the Gulf of Mexico. So if you know your seafood, you know, real well, intimately, you can pretty much know where it's coming from. But, I mean, you know, your question is a good one. You know, you really have to do your due diligence to know where your fish is coming from in this day and age. And even if they tell you it's coming from one place, can you always trust the distributor?
Exactly. Come on, a label that says Pacific Catch costs about a nickel to put on a package, but can you believe it?
That's a big if, and I'm just happy I'm a vegetarian, Brooks. That's all I'm going to tell you. I'm very happy I'm a vegetarian right now.
I'm not ready to switch over to peas and carrots completely yet, and I do like seafood. I had shrimp just the other day, and I know that, you know, we're talking about $300-400 million a month in revenue that these people bring in along the Gulf Coast. In this industry, you're talking about 3, 4, 5 generations of people that have made a good living and a healthy one bringing seafood into this country. Let's see what our callers have to say. But we got Mary on line one. Mary, what's going on out there?
Well, I just tuned in a little while ago, so I don't know if I missed if someone has asked this question before. I know we're talking a lot about the oil, and that is definitely bad, but I'm inclined to think that the dispersant that they put down is even worse. And I did email some of the governors from the southern states and wanting to know why weren't they using any of these oil-eating microbes that have previously been used on spills in Texas and apparently worked.
That's a good question.
And they were absolutely incredible. Do you have any idea about that?
You know, I don't know. I've heard a lot about these oil-eating microbes. I've received the emails. I've seen the internet press. But I haven't heard a peep out of the mainstream press about these oil-eating microbes and why there are still warehouses of it sitting unused by the bag, by the case. Why are these things not being employed?
Basically, it is because if you listen to them, they're always saying that they want to capture the oil, capture the oil. Well, if the oil microbes get out there and eat it, they can't capture it.
Well, I understand that. We're talking about 100 million gallons of oil or 100 million barrels. Maybe it's 100 million gallons. I can't remember the number so large. And it would be a significant loss for them to lose that oil. But how dangerous are these microbes if you spread them on, say, the marshlands? Will they just eat the oil and then go away?
Everything that I have read about them says that they have collected these microbes from all over the world and that they go in and they eat the oil and the any animal life that's in there, too, can eat them and it won't harm them. And when there's no more oil to eat, they die. They can eat the oil off the grass. They can eat it off the bottom. I mean, they forage for it. That's their job in life. And
there
it has cleaned up. I think it was in weeks that they cleaned up the one in Texas. I forget. It was quite a while ago I saw this. But I can't believe that in this entire country, nobody is going to use it. And you can't tell me they don't know about it.
Yeah, what stops a pickup truck load of well-wishers to buy a few thousand pounds of this stuff and drive along the marshlands and dump this stuff on and get it working? What's to stop them, Dr. Tom?
Well, you know, it goes back, Brooks, to that the whole framework here that's been set up, and that is that BP has complete command and control over the remediation and mitigation efforts. They've got it in lockdown. And unless you can convince BP to be open to these alternatives, and I'm getting, you know, I'm is the coordinator of the Gulf Oil Remediation Conference, I'm getting these emails and calls all the time, and we're sending them out and trying to make sure that the information gets to the right state departments to consider it. But as long as BP has command and control, you know, it's they're calling shots. They do what they want to do, and they don't do what they don't want to do. What really has to happen here, Brooks?
It's not even an American company.
I know. No, yeah, you know, we had a long conversation about that earlier, and I think what has to happen here is that you know, BP can continue, hopefully sealing this well off completely in the next weeks and months ahead. But in terms of the remediation and mitigation of the waters and the shoreline, all of us, I mean, without exception, we feel that that has to be taken away. That responsibility has to be completely taken away from BP. And we have a you know, our proposals. We have, if you go to our website, we have probably the most in-depth, advanced, technologically sound proposals for doing all these things.
What is the website? I'm sorry.
It's oil spill solutions now. oilspillsolutionsnow.org. And solutions is plural. But it's almost like
the horse is out of the barn already, and it is on its way to England. And I hope that that BP guy and his yacht get covered in oil.
Well, I have a text listener that wrote in, said that the microbe actually has to be cooked with the local water, and even then, it's a slow, steady, daily application. And the cleanup isn't weeks, but years. But it is thorough. It does work.
What does it mean, cooked?
I'm not really sure. He writes the word cook in quotations. As a biologist, I can tell you it probably means culture, that you have to culture the microbes. They're probably in some kind of endospore form. They have to be cultured in the water and then released so that they have kind of a kickstart to get going on the oil, and then they take off. But it's probably not a very fast control, a very fast process.
Well, it's been eight days now.
It is very much a two-step process here. You do have large plumes of oil, because there are a lot of things about this, the way that it's accumulated within the Gulf. You've got huge plumes of oil that have accumulated at the mid-level. You've got lighter grades of oil that have formed plumes above mid-level. You've got heavier grades that have sunk to the bottom. You've got oil that's interacted with the dispersants that's formed another type of formation. So you've got a lot of slicking and screening, you know, of oil that you can see all the way all across the coast of Louisiana, et cetera, over to Florida. So you've got a lot of different plumes and little lakes of brew here. Each one has its own signature point, its own characteristics, and you've got different colors. You can look at the colors of the oil on the surface, and that'll tell you a lot about what's dominating in its constituent. What's the primary? What is it? Is it foamy? Is it viscous? And all these are signature points that tell us what form it's in. In the form that it's in, each form will warrant a different response. When it gets into the marshes, you know, this is, as Brooks pointed out earlier, it's the marshes, the estuaries, the shoreline, you know, the wetlands. This is where you really want to keep it out of, because once it gets in, you can imagine how difficult.
It's already there.
It is in Louisiana, for sure.
I have
sure.
one more question, and then I'll let you go.
Sure, Mary.
For the lawyers that are behind this and everything, I hope that you will include the 27,000 oil rigs that are out there that have been abandoned. Because
that's a very good point, Mary.
That metal that's in those oil rigs, that's going to give out at some time, too.
Yeah. What you point to right there, and we circulated a number of articles and had a map of the active almost 4,000 oil and rig platforms just off the coast of Louisiana. It's right over towards Texas. And when you consider the amount of activity, I mean, very violent activity that goes on the ocean surface, in all of the room for error, where things like this can happen all the time, really. And the push for profits by the oil companies, where they cut corners and do things that they just are, you know, ought not to do unless they are willing to have a disaster like this, it really points to a whole new order, that the Gulf of Mexico has to be looked at macrocosmically. We got to look at everything
they're
doing.
Harry brings up a good point, because a lot of these rigs are 50 and 60 and sometimes 70 years old. They've been abandoned for a long, long time. Nobody goes out to those rigs and checks their structural integrity. They don't know if those things are going to flip over and snap off the casing. A lot of those wells have refilled back up. Yeah, they've refilled back up with oil and gas, and they could cause another spill. So it is dangerous. By the way, I want to bring up the point that this oil, once it's released from the wellhead underneath salt water, is osmotically dehydrated because it's going into salt water. But once it comes ashore and it gets into fresh water, it rehydrates. And so this becomes, the oil begins to break down and begins to break into its smaller components. This is one of the methods that they use in the refineries, is they use water to distill or to break apart the different molecular weights in the oil. Fresh water is used in the process. So that happens naturally in the marsh. And what's left behind is a kind of tar that will literally stay in the roots of these plants for 30 to 50 years, and it will kill the grass.
Yes, it already has. Well, I think it's pretty evident, to most people anyway, that we have to get out of the oil business. We
Thank
need
you,
to
Mary.
Find something else, like all these other things that have been held back. All these other inventions that have been held back, we need to get those out, and we need to start using them.
Well, at least for fuel for driving around. It's ridiculous. We have alternatives now. We're in the 21st century. There's no reason to keep shoveling our planet into our gas tanks and burning it. We have technology for that. But for durable goods, plastics, coatings, fibers, that's what the oil's for. And it's a much higher profit margin than gasoline. Mary's exactly right.
But if we were in the hemp business, we wouldn't need that. We needed to get hemp back then, because hemp can be used for all of that. For plastic, for paper, for clothes, for everything.
I concur with that, Mary. I'm a big fan of hemp and all of its numerous applications everywhere. It's a great, great, very versatile product. So I love that idea a lot.
And it's solar powered. I like it. Thank you very much for the call, Mary.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mary.
So, Mary brings up some good points. One of the things that people are concerned with now, first of all, let me ask you the question. Do you believe that the cap has been put in place? Do you think the leak has really been stopped permanently?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, you know, on the mainstream press today, Brooks, they're talking about there's a feud going on between BP and the government, where they're saying that they need to relieve the pressure because the methane that's showing up is indicative of breaches, and these breaches will be worsened. The longer that is kept under pressure, the more those breaches will increase, and they can, if there are leaks way, way low, they can be worsened significantly by keeping it under pressure. So we are not at the end of this by any means. We are not at
well,
the end
I know,
of this.
I know it sounds insane, but what are the chances that they could just hook the pipes back up, turn the well back on, and start pumping 80 million gallons a day into tankers and going back into business, relieve the pressure that way? Or do you think they're headed for the same thing happening again, another explosion?
Well, let me answer it philosophically, if I could, because I think that this is happening for a reason, and it's got the attention of the world in a way that, in my memory, I'm 53 years old, and I've never seen anything like this. It's like everyone is watching this. It's bigger than the Olympics, and I think it's because Mother Earth is using this little drama to do what Mary just said, to motivate humankind to the point of understanding and awareness that the hydrocarbon fuel paradigm has to be transitioned away from. With approaching 7 billion human beings on the planet, the oil and gas paradigm, energy source, it's no longer sustainable. And because it is so inherently destructive to Mother Earth, to the planet herself, because of that, I really believe that the only way, this is like a defining moment in human history, and we're being given an opportunity, and that we must consider the very deliberate movement over to energy sources, new energy platforms that are in fact clean and green, renewable and sustainable, environmentally friendly and ecologically sound, carbon neutral, truly cost effective. And I'm not just talking about solar and wind and photovoltaics, et cetera. I'm talking about, you know, a Tesla-like stuff, tapping into the freestanding wave energy of the solar system, which is a whole different gamut here, whole different realm of.
You're not only talking about a whole different gamut of technology, which I concur that a lot of that technology is sitting in prototypes in garages and basements all over the country, and we could bring it to fruition rather quickly. But there are two problems with that. Number one, and it's the one we face every single day in our industry, is access to capital. There's no banks, there are no investors, there's no federal grants or loans or any of that stuff feeding this energy capital in order to get to the marketplace. The other is legislative. It's got to come from the executive and legislative branches. And those branches, it appears, and I'm not saying this for sure, but it appears to me that they are bought and paid for. Because if you look at the laws, the legal high jumps that have been made in the last 75 days from a multinational corporation being able to usurp constitutional law, freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, these are basic laws we have in this country. They're not the complex late laws. They're the basic laws of this country. And a multinational corporation has been able to come in and usurp these laws and enact federal penalties against the press, against people who are trying to find out what's going on and fix it. And also against what you were talking about earlier about seizing the assets of BP. Where would the assets go? Would they go into the general fund of the federal government, or would they be redirected to these green energy sources? And if so, who in the world, who in our country would handle the distribution of such capital? Now, I met with U.S. Ambassador of Trade Ron Kirk Friday morning at 9 o'clock, along with Congressman Larry Kissel, and we were talking about trade issues. And the subject of the Department of Energy came up, and the ambassador said the Department of Energy really has a boondoggle on its hands because it's been handed so much money, billions, tens of billions of dollars, and it's their responsibility to distribute it to these energy ideas, to these technologies. I'm here to tell you, Dr. Tom, I'm in the mix. I'm on the front lines of this. Not a dime has gone to these innovative technologies. It's all gone to established large corporations.
And you're right.
Where
and I concur with that, Brooks, as far as the modus operandi in the past. Let me just say a couple things, because you're right on target, and I really do concur with what you say. In the political realities on the ground, I see that outworking all day long. But let me share a couple things with you that might surprise you. In light of the Gulf oil spill, the political calculus of the state of Florida has changed irrevocably because of this. One of the representatives, and she's actually my representative right here in Tallahassee, great lady, she voted for some of the oil and gas drilling that Charlie Crist was pushing for blowout. And now, literally, over the course of months, she orchestrated, coordinated the largest energy congress, alternative energy congress in the state's history, right in the Capitol building. Okay, and there wasn't an oil and gas person there. It was clean and green. It was solar and wind. It was you name it. I mean, she had people coming from all over the country. It was unbelievable. Now, this couldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened before the blowout. And what I'm speaking to is there's going to be a slow motion transformation of consciousness with this. It's already started. But for her and many of the other representatives here in Florida who have traditionally, you know, gone with the flow of the oil and gas industry, for them to change as they're changing right now in real time, you know, there's a sea change. Sea changes sometimes come quick and sometimes come slow. But when the ultimate effects of this spill are felt by the entire coastline, and especially the state of Florida, as we talked about earlier, these are the movers and shakers of the world. They live there. And when they can't go to their beach and they're affected so profoundly, so fundamentally, their lifestyles, because of what's coming their way, called the Black Wave, is the documentary producers named it. It's a black wave coming our way. And this, I believe, in a way that nothing else could precipitate such needed change, I do believe you're going to see things happen that would have never happened in a million years or any other way.
I hope it's the free up of capital to these kinds of technologies. Now, wind has seen some breakthroughs. In the last 5 years, for instance, a lot of wind farms have gotten funding that they would never, ever have gotten. And I got to tell you, even after they were built, I met with a wind farm company out in Idaho. They had 22 towers that were built. They were sitting there, all finished. And they were in lawsuits for 2 years to turn those on and start supplying energy to Idaho Power. That needs to stop. That kind of blockading of this energy from coming to the market has got to stop. And we've got to be able to free up capital to electric car companies, to energy conservation companies. There are companies out there that are wanting to build subdivisions full of 12-volt DC and 24-volt DC homes. Everything run on local power, off-grid, run with solar and with wind and with thermal and with hydroelectric power, local used energy. And this stuff is viable. I lived in a 12-volt DC house. It works just like a regular 110-volt DC house, except you don't have to worry so much about fires, electrocution. Oh, yeah, and electric bills. You don't have those either.
Well,
The capital's not there.
Yeah, well, you make a lot of good points. And let me speak to the root cause here. And we've talked about the root cause throughout the course of this hour and a half. Great discussion. And it goes back to this. We live in a civilization, the basis of which is the hydrocarbon fuel paradigm. It's the basis of the civilization. The power and the energy it derives from oil and gas predominantly, to a great degree, overwhelming degree. So these companies, and they call them the six super majors, but there are, of course, many others, but the six super majors, these are the largest corporations in the world. Okay, so, and they've been the largest corporations in the world for a long time. And so what I'm suggesting here is that, and we both can talk all day long about the very, very aggressive and active suppression of all of these alternative energies that we're talking about now, that the suppression has been conducted by the oil and gas industries. They have funded it. They have made sure that all of this has been suppressed worldwide, and they've done it in a way that I don't know that any other industry has suffered. Going way back to Nikola Tesla, who was badgered by them and just run out of town by them, and just, you know, so they really control the access to the development of all of these alternative energy technologies. They've really controlled it, and I think that this event, when I talk about bringing BP to heel, this isn't just about seizing assets to put into a unprecedented trust fund, Gulf Coast Trust Fund, for the sake of cleaning up the Gulf Coast and whatever other entities are affected by this catastrophe. It's also about bringing BP to heel to show, number one, that the world no longer is going to be beholden, because we are a part of the problem. We are responsible, all of us, to the extent that we buy into this paradigm, believing that it's the only way we can do it. It's not the only way we can do it. There are many, many positive, constructive, clean alternatives, as you know, probably in some ways better.
I agree, and I want to add something. These major corporations do not control access to this technology. The technology is out there. What controls the access to the technology is money. And what people have to realize is it's not the government that's the headwaters of all the capital in this country. It's you. It's the taxpayer. You're the people that are making the wages, that are paying the taxes, that feed the machine, that keep companies like BP in business, that keep companies like the U.S. government, and yes, they are a company. They own stock in American corporations, and they make a profit off of that stock, and they're not going to compete against companies they own. So when it comes to this...
That's a good point. I love that one.
What we're advocating here is a complete shift of paradigm. It's you, the American people, that have the money to bring this technology to fruition. Seek them out and get them cash so they can bring these products to market and change the planet around these corporations. And by the way, I was out yesterday driving around and I could not believe my eyes. Still, people pulling up to the gas pumps at BP. Now, go in and buy a Snickers bar and a pack of cigarettes, that's fine. But please, stop pumping the gas.
That's really quite unpatriotic as far as I'm concerned. you make very, very good points, and I agree implicitly with everything you say. It is about how we are going to allocate our resources as a people, and if the political will was there. And if, you know, a lot of it really comes to educating and edifying, you know, really making the people aware of how much more control and power we really do have. And we don't know that. If we knew that, we would have been off this paradigm decades ago. But I think this is a catalyst. I think this little gusher is not going to go away, because it's going to teach us something as a civilization, as a society. Is a society, by the way, that is thoroughly addicted to oil.
That's why we're here, to make this aware. By the way, my guest tonight has been Dr. Tom. His website is Oil Spill Solutions, plural, oilspillsolutionsnow.org. Go there, visit it, get involved, and let's stop the aquacide. Very good term you brought to this program tonight. I appreciate you coming on.
It's been my great pleasure, Brooks, and thanks so much for giving us this great forum to bring all of your listeners to the table, to have a deeper understanding of just what's going on here and how everyone can get involved. We really, really appreciate the extraordinary interchange here.
Oh, thank you so much. And if anything comes up on the lawsuit, on, you know, summary judgments or anything like that, you let us know. We'll put it right on the air. You got an open line right here.
You'll be the second to know.
And I appreciate it, sir. Thank you, and have a good evening.
Brooks, you do the same. Thank you. Good night now.
All right, good night. All right, our next guest coming on in just a few minutes, Aaron Kaplan. He's the author of a book called Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion. Let me tell you, this book is an easy read. You better read it twice. There's a lot of information in here. Don't go away. We'll be back in about 4 minutes with Aaron Kaplan. Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion. I'm sorry. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I was talking the whole time and had my mute button on. Very sorry about that. We've been listening to The Alchemist by Enigma, a great piece that we like. Our guest this hour is Aaron Kaplan. His book is Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion. He has been on the program before. We talked about the first half of this book. And it's so remarkable. There's so much information in this book. We wanted to have him on again, partly because some of this is very timely. Before we get into that, I wanted to remind you that you can get your copy of the ebook version of Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. There are advantages to doing this because if you do it, you'll not only get the book with all the color illustrations, but you'll get a 25% discount off the printed version. It's due out in a couple of, I want to say, weeks. It might be a month. We're still waiting on the publisher. As soon as we get the galley copy in our hands, we'll get the approval back to him, and it'll be available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and everywhere. But, of course, if you buy it at the website, you get an autographed version, and we will have the audiobook ready by that time. So you'll get the printed version, the ebook version with all the color illustrations, and the audiobook if you buy it from the website. So now would be a good chance to get a hold of that right now. So we can get your name on the list, get your coupon code processed so that when it comes out in print, we'll send it to you, and then you can have it on the shelf and have it in your head. It's important that you get this information as quickly as possible. We will be back in about, hang on one moment while I make an adjustment here. About 40 seconds with our guest, Aaron Kaplan. Don't go away. We'll be right back. That's one of the reasons we love internet radio, because everything is live. Everything happens right now. There's no pre-recorded anything. We don't edit this stuff out for the archives. You get all the fun and games that we see right here on the board. When we run it, we are a proud member of the BBS Radio Network. And if you think you have what it takes to be a talk radio host, please get a hold of me. We'll be happy to sponsor you to become a radio host on BBS and give it a shot. It takes a little bit of skill, a lot of passion, and if you've got a voice for it and a heart for it, there is space here at BBS Radio for you. Sometimes if it's not mainstream, it's right here at BBS Radio. My guest tonight, Aaron Kaplan, author, speaker, explorer, and we're happy to have him on the program. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
Thank you very much.
This book, I have my original copy with post-it notes sticking out all over the place. You could start anywhere you want in this book, but some things are really coming to fruition here since your last appearance on X Squared Radio. the idea, the notion, the subject matter of 2012. You know, 5 years ago, you might have found 10 or 15 titles on the shelves. Now there are about 10,000 titles on the shelves, all about 2012. And now we're even seeing some writers, philosophers, speakers, prognosticators changing the date. What's going on, Aaron? What's happening with 2012?
What's going on basically is one word called fear and blackmail. That's basically the truth. 2012
wow.
is a very real date. If you speak to any physicist, astronomer, specialist from a college, university, or museum, he'll tell you one thing. That something very astronomical will happen on December 21st, 2012. At least astronomical, plus other reasons. What will happen, number one, is a full planetary alignment of our galaxy. Every planet, with no exception, all the way from the Sun to Mercury to little Pluto, the little Martian moon, all the way to the end of our galaxy, will line up in line with our Sun. Number two, the first time since 26,500 years ago, we're going to enter what's called galactic center. We're going to go through the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Now, that by itself is not very bad. Could be a free trip like on a cruise ship. You go on a trip through a galaxy. Except for one thing. The center of the Milky Way galaxy is known to have dark matter. Now, many people think that dark matter is a black hole. It is not. Black hole has got magnetic pull. It will pull anything toward it inside out. Black matter is kind of a matter in space that is heavier than the air we breathe. Now, just imagine. Our planet travels through space roughly at 67,000 miles per hour, approximately. In some instances, our planet will even reach 100,000 miles per hour in space. Now, have you ever gone by a building or shipyard and see people remove paint, old paint from a deck of a ship or whatever? They use a sandblasting gun. Now, that air that's coming out of the gun is roughly 70, 80 miles an hour speed using sand. Now, just imagine our Earth going through black matter that is not exactly sand, but heavy matter combined with carbon and metallic particles at a speed of 67,000 miles per hour. What do you think will happen to our Earth?
Well, if you have high-speed particles coming in any kind of density like that, and they're of a different frequency, that is to say a different charge than what we normally see here on the planet, is you're going to see molecular changes on the planet, especially the surface of the planet, not just the air, but the water and the soil. And that means that the corn and peas and carrots and cattle and pigs and chickens and all the other things that we consume, which is the matter of the earth, is also going to change, which means our DNA is going to change. So it's going to be a biological, a molecular biological, and a molecular biophysical change right away.
You're correct. If your description, I don't think it's going to be a very pleasant one.
It's definitely going to be enlightening. I mean, I don't know if we're going to have three-eyed fish, but we're definitely going to have latent portions of our DNA re-energized.
Yes. Now, some astronomers even tell you, I've heard it on sci-fi channels, I read about it. They ask them, why is it different? And they tell you, well, we had a very similar alignment back in 1993. But we didn't really. And one more thing happened. To my understanding, for the last 3 to 4 or 5 years, the sun lost about roughly between 250% to 300% of its gravity. That means that now the gamma rays of the sun are able to penetrate space much deeper, and they are very poisonous, to say the least.
Well, they are. You know, gamma radiation is a broad spectrum of frequencies, and those of us familiar with the nuclides realize that gamma radiation can be stopped with lead or concrete or dirt or all kinds of things. It doesn't penetrate very deeply. It's the alpha decay that you really have to worry about. That's the danger of gamma radiation on human beings, is that neutron activates particles inside the human beings, which will decay as an alpha decay, destroying tissue. And this is what we call radiation sickness. It's how oncology works. That's how it functions, is alpha decay.
You're correct. Now, this is only one problem of the date, December 21st, 2012. That's one problem. There are at least two more problems involved in it that are going to sound like science fiction, but they are not. Supposedly, there's a planet out in space, supposedly, called Nibiru. According to many researchers, including the great Zachariah Sitkin, he's claiming that this planet has an orbit, a very tight elliptical orbit, which brings it to our planet roughly every 3,600 years. Now, until a few years ago, I would say until about 7-8 years ago, all the experts claim, including the Zachariah Sitkin, that the arrival date of this planet is December 21st, 2012. However, very lately, it seems that all these experts are having amnesia. They are now saying that the arrival date will be later and later and later.
Why is that? Why are they changing their minds? They were so sure about it.
Well, I'll tell you one story that I know of, only one story, which does involve the author, researcher, Zachariah Sitkin. It seems that roughly 6 years ago, he was summoned by the U.S. government under very strict secrecy and was sworn or was told to surrender all his findings regarding the planet Nibiru. By that I mean to say, we still have to surrender the dates for the arrival of the planet, and not to describe who the inhabitants may really be. Apparently our government is now very well aware, and so is the Vatican, to their experts, that this planet is arriving very, very soon.
Is anyone looking for it?
I personally am not sure of the exact date.
Have we got probes up in space looking for it? Do we have telescopes looking for it? I understand the only point of view that can really see the approach would be the South Pole Telescope.
Visually, you're correct. But we do have the IRIS, and we do have many other super telescopes up there that I'm sure they have seen it. And they are sending back data. Now, many Vatican observers, I understand 3 years ago, went to many observatories all over the country, including Mount Graham in Arizona, the South Pole, Australia, Africa. They were supposed to be there for a few months, look for a planet. I understand that most of those observers from the Vatican took one peek at the telescopes and 2 weeks back out of the bags and went back to the Vatican. They've seen it visually.
So what did they see? I mean, you know, planets don't put off a lot of light. You know, free-floating planets in the middle of space, have to have some kind of energy source, or they're just a large asteroid covered with ice. You got to have some sort of energy to keep a planet warm, or it just, you know, is a cold, hard rock in the middle of cold, hard space.
From my understanding, this planet Nibiru could be not only self-propelled, but it could also contain its own energy source from within. According to Sumerian tablets, they were interpreted many years ago by many experts, including Zechariah Sitkin, to describe the planet as having its own inside energy source. And also, very possibly, we do know from stories that its inhabitants, called the Anunnakis, are expert dome builders. I am not sure, nobody can really prove it, but I'm willing to bet if they can build domes on other planets, I am positive that they found a way to isolate their citizens on their planet of building domes there also. Mm. And also have internal energy from within. So that planet, I understand, is self-sustaining. And very, very possible, it's also self-controlled at times. That's all I can say to answer you the question in such a way where most people will understand planet Nibiru.
I don't have any doubts that Nibiru is on the way, because I don't have any data to refute it. But what are the sources of data that show that a planet is approaching Earth? If it's going to arrive 2012, 2 years, it could still be 200 million miles or more from Earth. It would be very, very hard to see a planet that far away.
You're correct. But apparently that planet emits, what I've read, a certain type of radiation around it that will seem to show up as a red pigment color with certain lenses. A certain type of radiation. And the experts say that they have seen it. Now, I don't have any access personally to any military satellites or gyroscope telescope or the Hubble. But what I understand is the experts have seen it. Now, their fear is not only the arrival of the planet, but there's one more thing here that's going on. There's one more fear. That fear is, as you know, according to legend and the writing of Sitkin and the Anunnaki, roughly 55,000 years ago, roughly, we heard of certain fallen angels who fell to this earth. They've been imprisoned here for approximately 55 million years. They're trying their best, the darnest, to escape our planet. They can't. The simple reason is that their superiors, the old Anunnaki gods, with very famous names that you may be familiar with, like Enki and Enlil, and one lady called Ishtar, the conference of the top gods, whoever they are, and they put a barrier around our planet. It's an invisible shield, which my book calls the Gamma G barrier. And I'm also stating in my book that the power plant for that barrier originates and is based on the moon. So if our moon is roughly 250,000 miles away from the Earth, so is the barrier. Try to imagine an invisible shield around the Earth, a mesh. Plasma that is designed strictly to detect, to hone in and destroy any living species, especially the Nephilim, with a certain DNA type that belongs to the Nephilim, those fallen angels. If any one of them will try to escape that barrier, it will detect them and will destroy them. Now, any other entity, or supposedly any other race of aliens, if they exist, including the Anunnaki, can come and go through the barrier whenever they want. But not any one of those supposedly called fallen angels. They cannot penetrate that barrier. And they're defined as darnets.
We could travel to the moon because we're of a different biological makeup, but the Anunnaki, the ones left behind, could not.
You're very close, but no cigar. I'll tell you why. By now, we are also contaminated with their DNA to crossbreeding for thousands and thousands of years. So we have to be very careful there. I was wondering for a very long time why our astronauts, now that of course is knowingly, we never heard of anybody trying to go past the moon, did we?
No.
Right. All we know is some of our astronauts landed on the moon, and through the rumor pile, we have been told, do not return to the moon. And of course, that became official about a year ago. I believe it was September 29th of 2009, there's an article in the Times where Obama said, we're not going back to the moon. No, how?
That's right. That's right.
Right. We'll go to any other planets. We'll go to the galaxy Vega, the Meatball Galaxy, Spaghetti Galaxy, Mars, but we're not going back to the moon. The question is why?
Yeah, why? I mean, you got water, you got oxygen, you got hydrogen 3, which is a great fuel source. It's a great launch base, and I can tell you right now, the country that controls the moon will control the Earth. Why not? Why not go back to the moon? What's the deal?
We have been told not to return to the moon, I believe, for one very strong reason. Do you remember the very famous La Crosse mission a month ago, last year?
The La Crosse probe.
It was supposed to be a rocket ship that we launched toward the moon.
Right.
Supposedly to find water. Supposedly. I don't believe that. I believe that a lacrosse mission with its warhead was supposed to, let's say, blow up a small crater in the moon, a path. Very close. Very, very close. But it's supposedly existing power plants that originates that invisible barrier around the Earth.
Ah, I see. You know, I wondered if they were going to take out some kind of structure that was already on the moon that was built by somebody else. That probe orbited around the moon for, well, a long time, several weeks, to get into position to drop this slug against the moon to make this plume that they checked out spectrographically. And we've had Alfred Lambert Weber on the program talking about it. And there was some speculation that there might be some explosives in this slug that they dropped on the moon, and that there was a specific target that they were waiting to line up with to drop it on. So what are your ideas about this? Why did we wait for this precise moment, this precise location, to drop this kinetic device against the moon?
I'm going to tell you why exactly. I'm not going to leave any blank spaces. Do you remember when our astronauts landed on the moon, Apollo 11, Buzz Aldrin and his friends? They tried their best to drill a few holes in the moon with some super hand drills that we built just for the purpose. I call them billion-dollar drills, the super diamond tips, drill bits. They couldn't even scratch the surface of the moon. They tried to drill a hole to put a flagpole in. They couldn't. At the end, they found some fishing line or some UPS line in the back of the spacecraft, and they tried to pull down to rocks. Stole the flag. That moon surface is so tough, so rough, they couldn't scratch it. That's number one. Number two, I believe personally that the moon number one is artificial. And it was brought to that area approximately 55,000 years ago by the Anunnaki for two purposes. Number one, to provide a power plant base for that barrier. Number two, to keep the Earth in check, balance the Earth. Now back to the moon with the bomb, which is my theory. Do you remember back in 1989 when President Reagan was president? He yelled to Russia, to Russia's Premier Gorbachev, break down the wall. We all remember that. Break down the wall. Well, the wall came down. But a very big miracle happened. Not one shot was fired. Do you believe that?
I believe that, yeah. There wasn't a war that broke out.
That's amazing. Why? That's because all the world powers, especially U.S., Russia, and China, are all in cahoots and controlled by the controllers of controlling the situation. Let me explain. As soon as the wall fell down in Berlin, Russia came to the U.S., if you remember, and begged us, America, please, take over from us at least 2,000 nuclear warheads. Take them apart in storage. We don't want them around here. We're afraid those nuclear warheads may fall into terrorist hands. Take them apart, dispose of them. Well, we took them very gladly. And 6 months ago, we took the last shipments. They gave us another roughly 500 nuclear warheads, total of 6,000 since 1989. Now, the question is, where did those nuclear warheads wound up? What a mystery. Some astronauts tried to warn us.
Yeah, we still haven't seen them pop up. We don't know where those warheads are. I know from a couple of sources, one is a little outfit in eastern Tennessee that takes those warheads apart and makes fissionable material out of it for nuclear power plants and also medical isotopes. And the other one is an organization that buries some of those cores deep in the earth where they belong, not as warheads, but just takes the cores out and deactivates them. Both of these corporations have reported not pounds, but tons of this stuff turn up missing. So you're exactly right.
Thank you very much. I'm right somewhere. I'm very happy to hear that. Now, here comes a funny story. Real funny story. Many astronauts try to warn us that something is going on in space. It's not very kosher. We heard of some drunken astronauts getting caught and bumped off the program on purpose. And, of course, then we heard about the lady astronauts that drove cross-country in a diaper. She tried to warn us of what's going on. Now, all we see is space shuttles going up to space. And all we see are TV pictures from Larking Live of every space shuttle do the same thing. They're showing one robotic arm picking up a barrel from one side, and putting the barrel on the other side. Another arm picking up one item, putting it on the other side. Now, come on, guys. After all those years of space shuttle missions, you're going to tell me that all we see are robotic arms flying and flopping up in the air doing nothing? No. All we heard of is maybe a few dozen space shuttle missions. But, folks, let me tell you something. We by now had not only hundreds, but I believe thousands of very, very secret space shuttle missions going into space to the moon and back, unknowingly launched from many other launching places on the face of the Earth.
Yeah, very well could be, because almost weekly rockets leave bases near the equator, actually. The French operate a rocket base near the equator that is very productive. They use it because the velocity, the rotational velocity of the Earth is very fast. It's very easy and very cheap to get into orbit. And we also remember very recently the X-37B was launched. We don't know what's on it. It's up for a 9-month mission. We don't know how much money was spent. This was a scrapped program from NASA because it got too expensive and there were no benefits from a robotic miniature space shuttle in the program. It was taken over by the U.S. Air Force. It was put on the expedited program, rapid launch program. Untold, literally untold amounts of money were poured behind it, and it was launched. And it is in orbit right now, and you can track it on heavensabove.com.
That's correct. Now, you just mentioned of a rocket being launched from the Alaska for the North Pole area. And many people don't realize that the North Pole area and the South Pole area is the area where the Van Allen belts, the radiation belts of the Van Allen belts, have the least radiation. The least. The Van Allen belt radiation figure, like a sideways figure eight, with the most radiation is to the left side and the right side of the Earth. But straight up north and straight down south, there's very little radiation. That's why many of our space...
It's reasonable to assume that the Van Allen radiation belts align themselves with the magnetosphere of the Earth. So the flux lines enter and leave the Earth around the poles, as they would any magnet. So that makes sense.
You're absolutely correct. Now, there are also stories that the Earth may be hollow. I believe it very strongly. The other reason could be why the radiation is so weak in the North Pole and the South Pole. Right at the center where the openings may exist, there's no soil there, no earth to form radiation. It's possible. It's possible. I believe that I'm mentioning it in my book.
Yes, you do. Right after page 160 in your book.
Right. I call it Physics 101. When you have no soil, no projectile radiation, there's very weak radiation in those areas. So I do believe that the Earth is hollow, definitely. That's also hidden very, very well from us. And now back to the moon. All those space shuttles, for all those years, through technologies that were never heard of, very advanced technologies, have helped to launch those rocket ships in space. Usually, I believe, the we already possessed anti-gravity machines for many, many years. And our government is using this technology to launch those vehicles into space cheaply.
Now, so the hydrogen peroxide rockets that we launch as space shuttles are really just a public show, right? You're saying that we have technology that can lift heavy vehicles into space without using rockets.
Bingo, you hit it right on the head, Dakar. Like the Agnew. You hit it right on the head. It's a great show. Wow. It's a great show. Unfortunately, of course, this can also be applied to free energy for vehicles and so forth and so forth and so forth. But that's not a story. Now, all those nuclear warheads are now wound up on the moon. They're already there. That Lacrosse mission, basically all it did is create a crater very, very close to the power plant to bury those nuclear warheads and get ready for a big bang. Now, let me explain what I mean by a big bang. If you remember for the last 40, 50 years or so, especially since after World War II, or or famous Roger Roswell, Dead Times Man. Many UFOs have been seen in our air. And of course, we had many, many abductions. Abduction of human beings by so-called, supposedly, space aliens. Folks, those abductions were never performed by space aliens. The simple reason is that if my research is correct and other researchers, that our galaxy, and especially our planet and Mars and the Moon, are fully controlled and owned by the Anunnaki race. The whole universe knows that. Many aliens can come to our planet, they can take pictures, the Polaroid shots, have a picnic, and leave. They cannot intermingle with our lives, especially abductions. Those abductions...
Because it's by the Anunnaki? The Anunnaki have control that?
Yes. The Anunnaki have terraformed many years ago two planets in our galaxy, Mars and Earth. Believe it or not, they've terraformed Mars first, then the Earth. And all we are, their story that we're supposed to be slave workers, or the Anunnaki, gold miners, no. I believe that all we are really is a pet project, pet, P-E-T. Like if you own some cats or dogs, they're your pets. We are a pet project of the big gods, Enki and Enlil and so forth.
Well, maybe that's we're a pet that's looking to bite.
Pardon me?
So maybe we are a pet that has learned to bite.
Yes, well, but we think you've learned to fight, except we have no idea what we're up against. Those Anunnakis have been around for over 45 million years. And, of course, they have 45 million years of advancement on us in the sciences, in the weaponry, and so forth. So if we think that we can build weapons to fight them, no, that's not going to happen. However, the fallen angels that are trapped on this planet, they're not all members of the Anunnaki. They're strictly space entities who the old Bible called cherubim, ophanim, seraphim. And the leader is from the seraphim sect called Lucifer. He's still around, but it's not a story. With him are also, I believe, one or two Anunnakis who broke the rules of life, the rules of creation, by intermingling with the women of Earth and having babies and so forth. Now, those trapped Nephilim, they have to escape by this date, December 21st, 2012, for two reasons. They don't want to be stuck here while our planet goes to the center of the galaxy again. They also fear what may happen to this planet. Number two, they fear one more thing. They don't want to be here to face the Anunnakis on their return trip from space. They don't want to be here because they didn't handle this planet very well. It caused many wars and many deaths. And I don't believe the Anunnaki leaders, when they do get here, will be very sympathetic to them. So well, they've been doing so far, the Nephilim, which they've been doing through abductions, yes, the Nephilim are responsible, I would say, for 99.999% of the abductions of humans from this planet, looking for a certain bloodline. They're looking for pure bloodline, pure, that started with Noah. If you remember, when God saved Noah, he told him, "You're a righteous man. I'm going to save you." Well, the word righteous didn't mean I mean, the praise every day or is honest and so forth. Noah carried a pure bloodline from way back. I believe not only from our planet, but I believe that Noah was, and his family did not originate on planet Earth.
Sure. We cover that in our books, too. I strongly believe that Noah and his clan, when they came here, brought a gene pool that was unique to the Earth, and maybe, just maybe, that biological line is preserved in certain gene pools on the planet. The question comes, Aaron, is that there are almost 7 billion people alive now on the Earth. All those souls, all the people, the actual animated beings that are inside the biological bodies that are here on the Earth, they're also not from this neighborhood, many of them. And we bring a powerful spirit to this planet. And if the Anunnaki are coming to conquest or to take over this planet, they're going to have a challenge on their hands.
They're going to have a couple of challenges. Number one is, let's put it this way. Do you remember the famous Middle Ages lady called Marie Antoinette?
Sure, of course.
And what happened to her? She was beheaded in a very, very fashionable style. What those Nephilim fear the most right now, I believe, to my research, is revenge. In the days of Noah, if you remember, there was no religion on this planet. None. There were no Jews, no Muslims, no Christians, just nomads. But Noah and his family and his bloodline had a very unique bloodline. Noah's family, if you remember, had names like, ten names from Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mawel, Jared. Jared, by the way, is a Hebrew word for Yarad, the person that came down from space. Then there's Enosh, Methuselah. And Methuselah spelled in Hebrew Methuselah, it means the men of the missile or the men of the rockets. Then Noah's father Lamech said to have sexual relations, not to the regular woman, but a goddess. It is now said that Noah is a mixture, a son of Lamech, a human, supposedly, and a goddess. That is why God wanted to preserve him so bad. That is also why, if you remember the famous statement when Moses came to Mount Sinai by the burning bush, when the so-called God spoke to him, he said, I knew your forefathers. And your Abraham, and your Isaac, and Jacob. That means that God, whoever God was following the bloodline of Noah very, very carefully for a reason. They tried to preserve a pure bloodline because they knew. When I say they and I say God, I don't mean the free gods of the Anunnaki. I mean the imprisoned ones. Because they knew that one day will come, or they may have to tap in to the pure bloodline, of Noah, in order to escape through the barrier in space.
Right? So it's this genetic key that they need to be able to get through this barrier.
Exactly.
Now, do you think the astronauts, there are only 12 sets of footprints on the moon, these are the only human beings to ever, that we know of, leave the Van Allen radiation belts, and very, very fortunately, we did not have great solar activity during these periods, or those astronauts would never have returned home, and if they did return home, if they were exposed to heavy solar radiation, that we do see outside the Van Allen radiation belts, they would not have lived very long. But they have lived very long, and they did make it to the moon and back. Do you think that their genetic lines, these few astronauts, were of the genetic mix that could get outside that barrier and make their way to the moon and back?
Oh, Dr. Agnew, you're so close. Let me tell you something. You're so close. Do you remember the name Gene Shoemaker?
Sure.
Okay. Gene Shoemaker supposedly was in charge of a special project of the astronauts called Project Clementine and a few other projects. Project Clementine was supposed to be a project to train the astronauts how to behave on the moon, to look for water.
Well, he was a geologist, so his job was to train all the astronauts in geology, which, believe me, none of the astronauts, the original ones who went to the moon, were geologists. So they went through months of training, geological training. That's why they set the geophones on the moon, so that we could monitor the geotechnic activity of the moon, how to take rock samples, how to preserve the samples, what to look for. So there was a lot of training that went on. It was Gene Shoemaker that led all of that.
That's correct. He spent so much time with the astronauts until he saw something very, very strange. Now, my book, I'm claiming that the crash in Roswell occurred because of DNA. I'm also claiming in my book that crash was simply a failed DNA experiment of the Nephilim. It was more than one crash, it was 7 or 8, but it's a different story. Now back to the astronauts. Gene Shoemaker noticed something very, very strange with the astronauts that have been returning from the moon. It seemed that they had to go to very, very extensive debriefings. Very extensive debriefings. Now, as I understand, most of the astronauts, not the ones to space, but the ones that walked on the moon, the ones that walked on the moon belonged to a certain party of people, not the Illuminati. They belonged to the Masons or Freemasons, most of them.
Sure. Let's see. I think of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon, they were all Eagle Scouts, too.
Yes, you're right. You're right. But the reason why I'm saying that, I believe that they knew what the mission may actually be. And I believe that that's the reason why Gene Shoemaker was killed on July 8, 1997, in the Tanami Desert in Australia. Can you imagine a lonely road, nobody on the road, and they hit another car? Out of nowhere, you found out something. Here's what I believe you found out. The reason why those astronauts, after they came back, they went to such lengthy debriefings, is two reasons. Number one, to debrief them, what they've seen, to keep the mouth shut, that's number one. Number two, there's a very strong possibility. Of course, I can approve that. That they were basically Roswell number two.
Ah.
Is it getting interesting now?
Yeah. Tell me more. I see the connection, but
okay.
I'm going to let you make
it. Okay. It's very possible that our Nephilim are so clever that they found a legal way of testing genes and DNA for the path to the barrier. I believe that those astronauts who actually walked on the moon were injected. I shouldn't use the word injected. There are certain blood transfusions, extensive ones, who through a few weeks recycled their blood with certain blood types, that the Nephilim will be very, very interested in finding out what will happen when they got to the moon. And I believe that Gene Shoemaker got a wink on it. And he was going to open his mouth. Well, he didn't have a chance to. he was killed. And that's the reason why the same astronauts, when they came back, after months and months of debriefings, were so incoherent and dizzy. That's the main reason. Those astronauts are very brave people. You can't just scare them to give them a mild shot or threaten them. No, that's not going to work.
Right.
I think it's a combination of physical damage and brain damage done by those blood transfusions. I call it Roswell number two. I believe that right now those Nephilim found their pure bloodline. They have it. If you remember, for many years, President Bush refused to allow stem cell research. However, President Obama last year, I believe it was March 9th of last year, approved stem cell research.
Well, under limited guidelines. In other words, President Bush was against farming of fetuses, which is where they were getting their stem cell. These were fetal stem cells. And what would have happened is it would have become a very, very lucrative industry, and we would have been involved on a level of fetal farming that was just ethically not acceptable to President Bush. So he blocked it. But the stem cell research that has been allowed is from the umbilical cord. This is from actual deliveries, not from abortions. And also adult stem cell research. We're still not doing fetal farming, as far as I know.
I agree with you. But it's also very possible that President Bush's days, they haven't found the pure bloodline yet that they were looking for. And it's also very, very possible that either by coincidence or by chance or on purpose, when President Obama approved that next step of stem cell research, maybe, I'm just theorizing, maybe as of that date, they did find what they were looking for, a certain bloodline. And then they authorized the full research, full speed. And if you notice, from that date on, roughly for about a year ago, roughly, if you follow the stock market, the scroll on the stock market, you see many hundreds of brand new companies that are doing microbiology research. They popped out of nowhere.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. No question about it. The industry is called bioinformatics, and it is big, and it's gotten a lot of investment in the last 5 years.
Right, and how many microbiologists have you heard of died within the last year or so?
Quite a few. I have been really shocked that they say that it's, well, they're saying it's hazardous for your health. And these people are not dying of natural causes, by the way.
That's correct. I believe that most of them, if not all, as soon as you find out what they're working on and threatening to open the mouth, that's the end. That's basically what's going on. And if you also notice the last year or two, many of the abductions who were very strong many years ago have subsided. You don't hear anymore of abductions. That tells me that they found what they're looking for.
Wow.
And they're working furiously right now in laboratories all over the world. I mean, all over the world. U.S., Australia, England, Israel, Russia, everywhere, to come up with a certain chemical in order that those Nephilim can reinvent themselves, or I would say the right word, reverse engineer themselves to fool that barrier, making believe that they are pure humans, not so-called angels or entities of Nephilim, because they have to escape. They have to escape.
That's an interesting take. It is really an interesting take. You know, my brother has been chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins for a couple of decades. And before that, he was dean of physiology or dean of biology at Yale. So he's been up there, and he's on a Nobel team. that's involved with the Human Genome Project. So I'm not completely disconnected from this, although I am not a molecular biologist. I'm a chemist, I'm a physicist, but I'm not a molecular biologist. The field fascinates me, but I'm not an avid researcher in it. I can tell you that the Human Genome Project recently published that after a decade of research, they have not found anything that's very surprising. And in fact, they kind of said that it's unfolding as predicted 10 years ago. The real world is that disease cures, like cures for diabetes, cures for kidney disease, even onset of Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease, there have been breakthroughs, but it will be decades before you see this in any pharmacological format. It could be that the real money driver behind this is exactly what Aaron is talking about, because if it was pharmacological, you would see those products hitting the market, and we're not seeing it hit the market. There's no return on investment, pharmacologically speaking. That means that the Human Genome Project and the funding behind it, and believe me, this is multinational, it is global, and we're not talking about billions of dollars, we're talking about trillions of dollars that are being spent on all kinds of levels. You would not believe the quality and the number of new buildings that have been built at universities, even right here in Charlotte, that just blow your mind how high quality these things are and how many doctors are coming out of this field. And I gotta tell you, almost none of them are American. He may be right. Keep going, Aaron.
Thank you. You remember that I mentioned for the word Marie Antoinette, okay? Now, what I'm going to tell you next is going to sound like a science fiction movie, or somebody's going to put me in a straitjacket. Just hang on to your hats. I also mentioned earlier that I believe that we are a pet project of the Anunnaki gods. They try to preserve us, because we are the last remnant of two civilizations. One that escaped from Mars roughly 55,000 years ago, and the original inhabitants of the Earth. We are the last leftovers. And Enki and Enlil want to preserve the bloodline very dearly, since we are so-called semi-success. However, because of many accidents and instances in wars, bloodbaths occurred the last couple thousand years, especially the last 60 years in Europe, Spanish Inquisition, concentration camps. Now, I have to be very careful here. I'm not speaking of religion, because remember, Noah was not Christian, he was not Jewish, he was not a Muslim. He was just citizen. Judaism didn't start approximately 5-6,000 years ago. And Christianity didn't start roughly 2,000 years ago. So I'm not talking about religion. You gotta be very careful here, folks. Very careful. It may sound like I am, but I'm not. We are the pet project of the Anunnaki. When they return here in about a couple of years, and they are returning, they're going to wonder, they're going to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, hey, whoa, wait a minute. Some people are missing here. Where did they all go? Who's responsible for the death? What's going on here? I'm going to tell you something. Some heads will fly. Some heads, including those of their own kind, the Anunnaki, were left behind here, and the fallen angels, the Nephilim, were not all Anunnakis. The entities from another planet called angels in the old days. But Anunnaki will destroy them. They've done it before. So here's the problem. Here's the problem. Do you remember the movie called Star Trek, The Voyage Home?
Sure.
Where space, right. A space probe comes to the planet Earth. And let me tell you something. This movie was not done by accident. And it's emanating a sound of the humpback whale.
Right. It was looking for a return signal from the humpback whale, which, of course, in that year was extinct.
That's correct. So the heroic crew of Star Trek goes back to the 20th century, finds two whales, brings them back to the 23rd century, and the whale is swimming again in the ocean and emanating sound, and the probe heard the sound of the whale, said, aha, success. Okay, I'm leaving. I'm not going to kill anybody. I'm not going to destroy the Earth. The probe left in peace. Everything is fine. Now, did you ever wonder why, after World War II, suddenly, out of nowhere, I mean, like instant, the State of Israel was formed?
1948, you're absolutely right.
Out of nowhere. The powers to be, the Illuminatis, the Bilderbergs, the Trilateral Commission, the different names, Dan, Rothschild, same bunch of hooligans, you know, same bunch of the right hand of the Nephilim, they knew they had to gather a certain group of people together in a certain place so they will be heard or seen from there as one, as a whole. That's my belief happened.
Well, I got a couple of questions here because, and some of them are anthropological. We do see that the Hebrew race, and believe me, it is a bloodline that has been kept, for all intents and purposes, as pure as possible. There are markers in the DNA of Hebrew descendants, Jewish descendants, the tribe of Judah, that are different than markers from any other race, other than maybe Eskimos or a couple of isolated tribes in Aboriginal lines. They are the purest bloodline on the planet. Now, all that staying inside the same gene pool for a couple of millennia has caused a lot of biological weakness, eyesight and skin and bones and some other things. But generally speaking, the genetic line is pretty pure. That's one thing. The second thing is this whole program and your book, which is a deep analysis, frightening conclusion, and I highly recommend that you read it, by the way. It's very, very poignant. The whole premise is that there has been a barrier built around the Earth to keep imprisoned certain, shall we call them, timeless beings. They almost live forever. My question is, Aaron, who built the barrier, and would they stand for this prison break that they're planning?
The people that build the barrier is the Council of the Anunnaki, the chiefs, the big gods. They taught in the moon. Now, the moon is, you see, the moon is not remnant of the Earth or any other planet due to collisions. It is not. The moon is artificial. It was brought here, it was stored in here from a very far away galaxy by the Anunnaki, roughly 55,000 years ago, for two purposes. Its main purpose is to house that power plant that emanates the power to create the barrier. And the second purpose is to keep the Earth in balance. And the race responsible for it is the Anunnaki. They've been in existence for just about over 45 million years, according to all records found, including the Sumerian tablets. 45 million years. They are actually in charge of the so-called angelic entities called the Cherubim, the Ophanim, and the Seraphim. It's the Anunnaki. They terraformed our galaxy. They terraformed two planets. They terraformed Mars and the terraformed Earth. They are in control of our galaxy. The Anunnaki.
So these higher Anunnaki, the higher Anunnaki, are they going to allow the beings that live on Nibiru to come here and wage war against us, human beings, with their weapons, because we are their pet project? Are they going to allow this to happen?
The higher Anunnaki are the inhabitants of the planet Nibiru. This is the home planet. They're basically coming here every 3,600 years to see what's going on. The last time they were here, if you remember, when I was on your show, I discussed Moses and the pyramids.
Right.
And what Moses did with the pyramids to divert Nibiru. To try. When they get here this time around, they may have an idea what's going on this planet through the emissaries that are left behind. One emissary is a female goddess called Ishtar. And believe me, she's around. She's actually been seen on many UFOs doing abductions. She actually introduced herself as the goddess Ishtar in quite a few cases. And I believe this is also the reason why back in the 60s, Dr. Alan Hynek was sent by the U.S. Air Force to investigate a certain abduction cases where the goddess Ishtar was seen. So when those Anunnaki return with their home planets, they're going to see what's going on here. And they're not going to allow the Nephilim to escape, or at least they're going to try not to allow. What they will do, I have no idea. I do know that approximately 55,000 years ago, the son of Enki, the big god, his name is Marduk, used a weapon was hot-headed, called the Spear of Destiny and the Tablet of Destinies. It's one weapon. One is the actual weapon, one is the computer. But they work together. I believe that he actually destroyed the planet Tiamat with that weapon 55,000 years ago, approximately. And unfortunately, when he used the weapon on planet Tiamat to destroy it, that weapon, the beam that was emanating from that weapon, may have accidentally bounced off Tiamat or go right through it and hit the planet Mars and caused the waters of Mars to evaporate. That's what I believe happened at the same instant.
Sounds like a pretty devastating miscalculation to me.
You're absolutely correct. It was a disaster. If you check our archaeological findings on Earth, the landing strips in Peru and Central America, and in Middle East, the Sinai Desert, and certain places in China, all those landing areas are now being dated slowly, slowly, to roughly 45, 50,000 BC. Slowly, slowly. That means that many entities or human beings from somewhere came to the planet Earth around that time. We also heard of many migrations around 40,000, 50,000 years ago of many masses of human beings going from east to west and west to east.
Sure, yeah, a lot of migration, a lot of frontier expansion.
Right.
You know, we have about 5 minutes, Aaron. I want to get this question out. Why did the higher Anunnaki imprison the Nephilim here on Earth with us?
They imprisoned them basically for two reasons. They were repeat offenders. They basically had sex with human women of Earth. Not Mars. Now, be careful. Not Mars of Earth. They've contaminated the pure bloodline of humankind on Earth by doing that.
Mm.
Because there were stories. When the Nephilim came to Earth, there were giants on the Earth at the time. And the only way the giants are created, they were born by birth through human women with sexual relations with the fallen angels. So that means they were here before creating the same sin. And they did one more thing. They created dinosaurs. And, of course, humankind could not coexist with dinosaurs. So basically perform two sins, which the big gods will not forgive for. They chased them all over the universe until they finally imprisoned them on Earth.
Well, thank you very
much. Basically, sorry.
Hang on a second, Aaron. We do have a caller, Lynn from Eugene, Oregon. You're on the program. Can you add a little bit of clarity for us?
You know, I don't know if I can add any clarity as in regarding the Anunnaki tribe. I've been studying it myself. I had an experience when I was 7 years old. My sister had a paper out, and I got permission to go with her. And she told me the night before, hey, Len, there's these things in the sky. Well, I thought nothing of it because I was seven, and I was just excited to get out in the middle of the night with my bike, you know. So we got there, though, and instantly, I mean, the minute we got to the drop box where, they, you know, you put your papers in, I heard those things up there. And, you know, she told me just to go up the street a little bit, and we did, and there was about 30 cats up the road just kind of in a circle, not a perfect circle, but there's about 30 cats in the street in the middle of the night, and it just really weirded us out, and all of a sudden those things started booming up again, up in the sky and moving all around zigzag patterns, and I looked up at my sister, and she dropped her jaw, and that's all I remember, you know? And 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I had my firstborn son, and about 3 months into him being, you know, in our house, I was up late one night, I think it was around 2 o'clock, and I had this weird feeling, and I walked around my house, made sure all my windows were shut, because, you know, I thought maybe someone's going to, you know, break into our house. And I walked back into my living room where my son was in his crib, and there was this black shadow figure looking at him, down at him, for about 2 seconds, and it hovered across the room and vanished into the wall. I never told my wife. I never said a thing about it. I thought it was a ghost. I started researching. Here's my question. There was a period in time where I've heard two noises go off. I know this is going to sound crazy, but I've heard two noises go off in the back of my head. And the first one sounded like this. Back of my head got numb. My stomach felt nauseous. I felt queasy. And I never said a thing. I was listening to the Coast to Coast AM show at that time, so I was just taking it in all at once. But the second time, it went off, and it lasted for 45 seconds, 30 to 45 seconds. There was no static noise, and it just sounded like this. Lasted for about 45 seconds. That noise has came from my car. It has came from my Sony Walkman, and it has came from my Dell laptop speakers. I contacted Whitley Strieber and asked him what he thought I should do about it, and he said I should go see a doctor and all these things that would cost a lot of money. I can't afford, obviously. It's not your guys' fault. But my question to you is have you ever heard of someone who has made this claim where they've heard that type of noise come from the back of their head?
Yes.
There are many stories, many strange stories, like the one you just told on the air. However, all I can tell you is one thing. Most alien races, or all of them in this universe, know that they cannot come to this planet and play games. They cannot, or they'll be obliterated by the Anunnaki. Number two, those same Nephilim who are here, or the Anunnaki, they don't play games. They don't even want to be seen. They use emissaries to do the work, the dirty work for them. So if you heard anything, I can't really explain. It may be an accident, an aberration of something, storms nearby. I know I'm going to sound like a debunker, but I'm not. But
no, I just,
those entities here do not play games. They do not play games.
Ever since that happened, I've been researching into it night and day. Sometimes I take it way too serious. I'm surprised that my partner is still with me through all of this, but it's really opened my eyes. And that's one thing that's really stuck with me while I've looked into this is the Anunnaki tribe who used to live here. I've watched the History Channel on it, YouTube, big time YouTube, and I've never heard of anybody state that they've heard this noise come from the back of their head. But none of this ever came back until I had my son. You know?
I have heard of this noise. I have heard of the static noise, the buzzing sound. Small beeps, and it's
really?
Kind of, I don't know whether the signal is being laced into broadcasts, but sometimes I've heard people tell me that they hear it without the radio, without the cell phone, without anything going on. They just hear this series of beeps, almost like Morse code, but it's
yeah, that's what, the first two times it happened, it came right directly from the back of my head. This noise did not come in my ear canal. It came from it. I've never heard a noise so crystal clear, you know, and I never went to a doctor. If it was like a voice telling me things, I would have went to a doctor and just been straight up about it. You know, I have kids. I don't want to, you know, but this is different. It was like you said, a transmission. And it made me think about my experience when I was younger, when I was seven. And
So it did bring up a memory. It did have an effect of triggering something in your mind.
Oh yeah, well I mean, absolutely. At the time I was just, ever since I saw that thing in my house, I started looking into ghosts because that's what I thought it was. But the more and more I looked into it, they said that, you know, these things could deal with ETs. And then it made me think of when I was seven and it was a gradual process. I was listening to the Coast to Coast AM show and there's a lot of great speakers on there with George Norrie, George Knapp, all the guys, except for Ian Punnett. He goes on a different line, which is cool, but it's been a huge experience, and I've looked online, and it talks about the mark of the beast being microchips being put in the right hand or in the forehead. I didn't hear this come from my forehead. This came from directly in the back of my head. But I just wondered if you've heard anything on that either.
I haven't done any research into it, but I have heard of it before, but we'll do a program on it. You're on X Squared Radio now, so we approach things from a little more scientific point of view, not so much entertainment, although we try to be entertaining. And I will definitely do some research on it, Lynn, and I promise you we'll do a program on it and find out about it.
All right, well, I thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you very much. Aaron, we're just about out of time, got about two more minutes. So what I want to do is definitely inspire people to pick up the book Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion from Aaron Kaplan. And you can get the book everywhere, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, any of the online places. Do they get some benefits by going to your website and buying the book, Aaron?
Well, the only benefit going to my website is look at the beautiful artwork that I have there and some stories I have there and some background of the book. Which may entice them to buy the book. And it's a really good website. And like you said, to buy the book can go almost anywhere. Barnes & Noble, Amazon, it's also on e-books. It's pretty readily available.
Well, we appreciate you coming on the program and opening this amazing subject of not just humans living on the Earth, but other races. And they're not here by choice. And maybe they're trying to make the best of it, but we sure seem to see some systemic meddling in the economics and anthropological growth and our ability to get along with one another on this planet from what seems to be a timeless source. Decade after decade, century after century, millennia after millennia, they bring us to task over and over again. It seems like we never learn from our mistakes, because we're being inspired and taught and led in a certain direction from a small group of mysterious leaders with great amounts of knowledge and able to carry forth their mission generation after generation. At least that's what it seems like to me.
Yes, you're very correct. And all those leaders, like I said, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But if I'm right, many of those leaders, for one reason or another, a couple more years, be very careful. Only if I'm right.
Well, I think we should put together a committee, and when the Anunnaki get here, we vote for their removal from our planet.
That's not going to work too well.
Well, listen, we really appreciate you coming on the program, Aaron, and we'll have you on again. Awesome, awesome information. Thank you very much.
And thank you. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Have a good rest of the week, and we'll have you on again.
Thank you.
Good night. There you have it, Earth Explorers. We're so glad that you came here today. We talked about some amazing subjects, current events on the BP oil spill. As you dig into the archives, coming months, coming years, be sure to come back and listen to this program, because we unearthed some things here that, if true, will make their way to the mainstream and will make their ways to the annals of truth forever. And you heard about it here first on X Squared Radio. We will see you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.